This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
By the year 2050, the OECD estimates that emerging markets will account for more than half of worldwide economic output in US dollar terms. Yet globally, investors remain significantly underweight emerging market assets. What's behind this investment gap, and how might closing it benefit portfolios? My name's Harry, and today I'm joined by Uday, affectionately known as Woody Patnick, Head of Emerging Market Debt in our Active Strategies team, and Eric Luth, Emerging Market Economist in our Asset Allocation team, to get a view on all things EMD. Eric, thanks for joining us today. Can I start by asking you about that gap between the economic clout of emerging markets and their representation in fixed income portfolios? Do you have some figures that can give us a general sense of the disparity?
Of course, Harry. According to the IMF, EM sovereign debt accounts for about 30% of all outstanding sovereign debt globally. But global investors only hold about 15% of their sovereign debt portfolios in emerging markets. So most of this gap is due to China. You know, China has capital controls. Some investors are staying away from China for geopolitical reasons. So most of the gap is really due to China. If we exclude China, the global the underweight of global investors is much less. So it's 13% outstanding bonds globally of emerging markets and 11% held by global investors in their portfolios. Now, within that underweight, one country stands out, and that's India. Again, that has a lot to do with historical capital controls. But at the moment, these are being dismantled. India has announced a fully accessible list of bonds, which are much easier to buy and without limits by foreign investors. And these bonds are now being taken into global bond benchmarks. So this underweight should dissipate over time. And also over time, at the moment, it's only a share of outstanding Indian bonds that fall into that category. Over time, we also expect that to be expanded.
Thanks, Eric. Uday, welcome to the podcast to you as well. I wonder if you can paint a picture for us of the emerging market debt universe as it exists today, compared with debt markets that many of our listeners may be more familiar with. Just how big is the EMD world? And what would you say characterizes the many and various issuers that make up this increasingly important market?
Look, let me start by saying that emerging market debt, when I started investing nearly three decades ago, or just over three decades ago, was very nascent. But today, the investable universe of emerging market debt is over $27 trillion equivalent. Okay, that's the investable universe. Now, the majority of that, so let's say approximately 23 trillion equivalent, would be local currency debt or debt issued by countries in their own currency rather than, let's say, in dollars or euros or, you know, various hard currencies. Okay, the 4 trillion, so let's say 23 is in local. 4 trillion, roughly speaking, would be hard currency debt split between both sovereign and corporate. Off that 4 trillion, about three quarters of it is corporate hard currency debt. The other point that I would make is that it is an ever expanding universe, right? That if, let's say there are roughly 193 countries or so in the world, and about 155 are emerging market countries, but only, roughly speaking, 74, 75 countries or so are currently in the major indices like the JP Morgan indices. So you can imagine over the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, the growth has still yet to come. Many more countries and many more companies in those countries will be issuing bonds in the international markets and local markets.
The ebbs and flows of the US dollar, of course, are important for all investors, really. But the path of the greenback is particularly important, I think we can say, for emerging market debt investors. Eric, can you summarize how the dollar cycle has played out for emerging markets over the past decade? And if this cycle were to approach an inflection point, how significant would that be for this asset class?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The dollar is probably one of the strongest determinants of EM asset performance. Of course, what we are capturing with the dollar cycle is really the tightness of U.S. financial conditions and therefore global financial conditions. So when U.S. interest rates are high, the dollar is strong. Global interest rates are high, and there is less financing available for emerging markets. We have shown in research that EM growth is significantly weaker during those periods of dollar strength, and also EM asset performance is much weaker during those periods. Now, the dollar has been strong for more than 10 years, really, since 2014. And it has not been an easy decade for emerging markets and emerging market assets, I would say, with the exception of hard currency debt. Now, in the short term, it's not really clear that the dollar will weaken. If anything, Trump policies look a little bit on the inflationary side, and that would keep interest rates higher for longer, would keep the dollar stronger. But when we eventually get out of this strong dollar cycle, I would really expect a bonanza for EM assets.
Uday, one of the common questions about EMD concerns debt levels relative to GDP. Mm. On the face of it, the top 20 emerging markets, global emerging markets, have a much lower debt to GDP ratio than the average advanced economy. But I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard the argument that debt as a percentage of GDP needs to be lower in emerging markets because of the existence of the shadow economy and the greater difficulty of mobilizing revenues in general. Is there a way of accounting for this difference between developed and emerging markets? And if there is, what's it tell us about the debt profiles of emerging market sovereigns?
So what's very interesting is, let me give you first an aggregate number. Roughly speaking, we believe that emerging market government debt to GDP is about 65% or so versus 125% for G7. Okay, so 65 versus 125%. But out of that 65% debt to GDP in emerging market, what I have to honestly say, it really depends, because emerging markets today comprises countries that are in default, triple C's, but are current on their debt, B rated, double B, all the way to double A credits, right? So you have the entire spectrum. Now, as you would expect, generally speaking, the investment grade emerging market sovereign credits, they have generally much smaller debt to GDP ratios, or that they're debt to GDP in hard currency is relatively small. Where, as you would imagine, the risk generally would lie would be in the very low rated, the single B, triple C credits, where quite often you would see a higher debt to GDP. And I'd like to just highlight that, you know, quite often when people think of emerging markets, they think of this sort of monolithic sort of asset class. But, you know, you really, depending on the volatility you want, the credit rating you want, and, you know, the type of returns you're targeting, the yields you're targeting, you know, you could decide that you want a portfolio in investment grade rated credit, sovereign or corporate, or in high yield. And they will behave a bit differently during risk-on cycles and during risk-off cycles.
Another possible misgiving about emerging markets is that monetary policy hasn't always been to the benefit of long-term prosperity. Eric, is the idea of monetary policy as a source of volatility in emerging markets still essentially valid? And thinking about the wider question of emerging market vulnerabilities, what stands out for you in terms of the direction of travel?
Yeah, to answer that question, I first want to pick up on something that Woody said. It's a huge universe. It's very diverse. So in what I'm saying, I'm going to focus just on the top 20 emerging markets in terms of size, liquidity. So we're talking here South Africa, Turkey, Brazil, these kind of emerging markets, and not the Angolas and Sri Lankas of this world. So if we look at those 20 top emerging markets, which are really the mass in terms of GDP and liquidity, you can see that they have made great strides. I mean, you talked about monetary policy. Most of these countries are inflation targeters. They have been for the last 20 years. Most of them have flexible exchange rates, which makes them much less vulnerable to shocks. The Fraser Institute in the US ranks countries along several dimensions, including monetary policy. And the Fraser Institute finds that in terms of monetary soundness, these emerging markets really are now almost at par with advanced economies. So very sound monetary policies. But it's not only the monetary area where they have made great strides. The median emerging market is running a current account surplus. They've accumulated large levels of reserves. The share of hard currency debt within the sovereign debt has fallen to very low levels, which was a key vulnerability in the past. And as we already touched upon, government debt is lower than it is in advanced economies. And we can also see these strong fundamentals in the outcomes. I mean, we haven't seen a major emerging market crisis since 1998. I mean, the last big global crisis emanated from the US, not from emerging markets.
Uday, a shifting perspective a bit now from economics to portfolios, how has EMD historically performed as a diversification asset? And are there market environments where an allocation to EMD might be particularly appropriate based on historical trends?
Yeah, so one thing that, again, I think we need to understand about emerging markets, that we should think about emerging markets fixed income as sub-asset classes, i.e. there's hard currency sovereigns, there are hard currency corporates, and then we have EM local markets, right, where you take the local currency risk and the local rates risk. So let's think of these as three sub-asset classes within emerging markets fixed income. Now, what you'll realize, whether you look at the numbers over 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, which we do, that hard currency sub-asset classes, so sovereign hard currency, corporate hard currency, if we were to just to look at the JP Morgan indices, right, for those sub-asset classes, the Sharpe ratio is frankly superior. And this would, if we take the data before the global financial crisis even, right, superior to many advanced economy investment grade indices, right? Now, what doesn't fare particularly well, and actually it's relatively poor, would be EM local markets. If we were to take the Sharpe ratio, for example, over the last 20 to 25 years, okay? The drawdowns also look very differently if we're looking, for example, at hard currency investment grade versus hard currency high yield. And by that, I mean during crises times like COVID, whether it was the global financial crisis, and so forth, you'll find a very different volatility profile, right? So, and this is the one thing I really want to highlight to our investors and clients listening, is it's incredibly important to not think of emerging markets as, again, as this one monolith asset class. It comprises a whole spectrum of ratings, both in hard and local currency. And as a result, you have very different volatility profiles, Sharpe ratios, drawdowns, and so forth.
At the start of this podcast, I mentioned that forecast about the contribution of emerging markets to global economic output in the year 2050. Of course, it's impossible to know what the next quarter of a century might bring. But are there any important milestones that you feel listeners might watch out for in the years ahead? Eric, what would you point to?
I mean, I would first think of economic might, of course. I mean, China will one day, that's still probably two decades away, become the world's largest economy. India is going to overtake Japan and Germany pretty soon in the next 1 to 3 years to become the world's third largest economy. So, yeah, those will be wake-up moments. And then, you know, finally, also cultural influences. I mean, imagine a Turkish or a Nigerian soap on Western TV. We have seen this before with Korea, right? I mean, 20 years back, nobody would talk about Korea in the cultural sphere. Now everybody eats Korean. Everybody knows Squid Game. We listen to K-pop. I think we will see this across many other emerging markets in the future.
Yep, lots to watch there, Eric. Uday, what do you see on the horizon?
Well, okay, if I, you know, and we do spend, Eric and I, a lot of time thinking about the next 5 to 10 years, right? Because, you know, when you're investing, you're trying to think forward. So my belief is that a multipolar world is emerging, okay? And so if I were to look over the next 10 years, let's say by 2035, I think there will be four poles, okay? The U.S., of course. I think China will be a pole. I think the EU will be a pole, and I think India will be a pole, right? Now, what determines sort of these superpowers? And in my opinion, there are a few musts that you need. Number one is economic power, and we're seeing that, for example, out of China. Eric has already mentioned India. We're in by 2027, India will be in U.S. dollar terms the third largest economy, of course, in PPP. It already is. So you need to be, I believe, a space power. And both China and India are likely the top four space powers, along with Russia and, of course, the U.S., the preeminent space power in the world. You also need to be a military power. And if you look at military spend in U.S. dollars, of course, after U.S., we have China, Russia, and India, right? And then you have soft power, as Eric has rightly alluded to. And again, you see that out of countries like Korea, China, and of course, India. You know, it's the cuisine, it's Bollywood, you know, cricket, the IPL, and so forth. So, you know, I tend to think in 10 years that, yeah, we're emerging into this multipolar world where today the growth impulse is from emerging markets, primarily China and India. And I think over the next 5 to 10 years, the growth impulse will again be from India and then China, that the impulse will reverse, number one and number two. So I think it's an exciting time, frankly, to be, you know, looking at emerging markets. They have done very well over the last 30 plus years of my career. You can see that in the credit ratings and so forth, percentage of world GDP, growth impulse. But, you know, it's not like it's a trend that's over. It's a trend that is still moving forward. And the last thing that I'll point out, several consulting firms and multinational or multilateral organizations have put out pieces by 2050, where do they see the world? And, you know, if you look on PPP terms, the top 10 economies in the world by 2050, they quite often have at least six of the 10 largest economies in the world emerging, what we today call emerging market economies, you know, led by China, frankly. Followed by India, and then countries like Mexico, Indonesia, and so forth.
Well, Uday and Eric, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts on this fascinating topic. Really learned a lot there. I think the multiplicity of the EMD world is the message that I've really taken away from the talk today. And thanks to everyone who listened as well.
Thank you.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of Legal & General Investment Management Limited, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for information purposes only, and we are not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general economic, market or political issues and/or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not an offer or recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against Legal & General in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this document contains third-party information, the accuracy and completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person resident in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulation. Copyright 2024. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. In Hong Kong, this material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on X, formerly known as Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.